This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in today for Dan Hurley. It's our weekly news review show, and it's been another busy week. Joining me to talk about this week's stories at Cincinnati City Hall are Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Dan Horn and Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams. And joining us soon will be WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz. Later in the hour, I'll talk with political writer for the Lexington Herald-Leader, Daniel DeRocher, for a wrap-up of this year's Kentucky General Assembly session. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100, or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Well, good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
My
how things can change overnight.
Or by the hour.
Amanda, yesterday afternoon we found out that Greg Landsman had changed his position on Harry Black's future as Cincinnati city manager. Tell us what he said in his statement.
So it basically seemed like he was really moved this week because of what he heard at the call center testimony. He's not necessarily moved because he thinks that Harry Black should be the scapegoat in this situation with Kyle Plush and the 911 call center. But he did say he was kind of hinted that he wasn't really satisfied with some of the responses that Black gave and that he seems to be focused elsewhere in terms of attacking the mayor. He released an FYI memo on Wednesday after city council met, and he didn't really say anything about the call center or provide any updates at all. So I think that is kind of what pushed Greg over the edge.
And, of course, that changed the dynamic because the vote was 5-4 basically against terminating him to now it's 5-4 to terminate him. Jason, you had had a column that came out yesterday on this topic, and you, I think it, I'm paraphrasing the headline, but when will it end? Did you have some indication that, maybe it was going to end
on
Thursday?
I did. I had some indication that I don't have a crystal ball, but I had some indication that Landsman was going to flip. I knew he was not happy about Harry Black's approach in the in the couple meetings, I guess, the Tuesday meeting and the Wednesday meeting. That I mean, to sum it all up, he didn't like the fact that he wasn't really, you know, showing, I guess, taking really full any kind of responsibility for it. And at one point, I think he kind of deflected and said, I'm paraphrasing, but that, you know, there was pushback from the electeds, and I don't think he liked that. I literally, after the 5-hour meeting, I had grabbed Landsman just by the arm to catch him for an interview, and he was shaking. I mean, that's how upset he was, and I was taken aback by that. So I'm not surprised by what decision he made.
Dan, I'll let you weigh in here.
Yeah, I think the ground shifted under this whole thing that night. That Tuesday meeting is when things really started to go south, and you could, if you're in that room, and when that family started to get visibly unhappy, and you know, Wendell Young was speaking and saying some things that really bothered them, and I think everyone in that room knew at that moment something was shifting here, and you could all feel it going south. And I even though Harry wasn't speaking at that time, I think that just exposed a lot of the raw nerves and raw emotions that people were feeling. And that was it, I think. And you could see, if you watch some of the video we put online after that, I'm sure Channel 9 did the same thing. You look at the faces of the councilmen after that family walked out of that room, and they are all visibly shaken. And that's a culmination, I think, of a lot of things that happened before they walked out, but that just kind of really hit home.
And it plays into our discussion about Harry Black's possible ouster, but we'll talk more about that Tuesday night hearing a little later. You were getting ready to say something, Amanda. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to add, too, I think a lot of people were really concerned that there would be a politicization of Kyle Plush's death. And I think had the manager reacted a little differently, we might not exactly be in this spot yet, because I think the five that were still not moved to vote against his firing, they did not want Harry to be used as a scapegoat. And there was a lot of concern about that. But I think what ultimately pushed Greg Landsman in particular was just the poor reaction. I think on Wednesday, Harry Black was asked, do you have any comment today for counsel? And he said no. And I think that was kind of a nail in the coffin there.
I think part of what you're seeing, too, is what happens when you have a city hall that's so dysfunctional. You have the two top figures at City Hall at each other's throats, and then this happens. Then a crisis happens. And I think that's just a reflection of how you respond when you're in crisis mode. And City Hall's been in crisis mode now for weeks and weeks. And, you know, it may not necessarily be a reflection on any one individual's management skills or anything, but because everything is the way it is at City Hall, you drop a crisis on top of that and no one knows how to deal. And this is where we're at.
And in the end, it's clear someone had to go between the mayor and the city manager. The mayor is not going anywhere because he can't be fired. There's no recall provision in the charter. So the only one of those two that can go anywhere is Harry Black.
And that's what I said in the column yesterday is that, I mean, that's the – what I say is that it's the easiest, most logical step that can be taken right now. You know, the fact that it was – the effort was already underway to oust Harry Black long before Kyle Plush. And then in the wake of that, all these things have come out. And it's interesting because, I mean, I've gone back and looked at, you know, so many, you know, the I-Team did stories on the 911 center. The Inquirer's done multiple stories over the last 3-4 years. All these memos, all that. I know we'll get to that. But it's just like someone, you know, ultimately as the top administrator in a city manager form of government, you know, he's the one in charge of the daily operations. So, I thought this was probably the right decision. Now, Cranley's no saint in this whole thing either. His temperament and his approach is costing the city a lot of money with settlements and buyouts. And certainly, I think there needs to be some accountability there from council moving forward. But what I thought was that you get kind of Harry, you know, for lack of a better, for out of the way, and then you can deal with Cranley. Because he was put there by the people. So, you know, he wasn't hired directly, you know, as an employee like Harry Black was.
And Landsman's statement definitely hinted that that's what he would like to see, right, is some more accountability on the mayor, that he has to change. Now, it's going to be interesting seeing if council can convince this mayor, who is very strong-headed, as we all know, to change his approach.
Now, Harry Black had the option of resigning. He has an ordinance that was passed. I'm losing dates. I can't remember the end of March or the first
sometime
part.
Sometime within the last month and a half.
Sometime after March the 9th that council basically gave him a buyout. If he resigns, he would get 8 months of salary benefits. As far as I know, today he has not resigned. I assume he's at City Hall today. I did ask a couple of people, but they couldn't tell me for certain that he was there. So council now has called a special meeting for 9 o'clock tomorrow morning to discuss termination.
Every reporter's dream after a week like this. yes. So basically council has the new majority five has basically said you can either resign or we have the votes to fire you tomorrow. Either way, he gets the 8-month severance package. What is different if he doesn't? If he chooses to resign, he will get benefits such as, you know, health care for a pension as well. But if he chooses to be fired, he doesn't have – he has the ability to possibly sue the city, basically. That's something he gives up if he resigns.
Do we know yet – and I've – maybe you all have found this answer to this question. I've tried. Do we know what they're going to vote on tomorrow? Are we talking an ordinance? Are we talking a motion? Because process in this situation is important.
I believe it's to essentially be able to expedite it. It's a motion. So, but if it were an ordinance, they would have to go through three readings in committee and then bring it to council. But by doing this so quickly, Cranley's trying to do it through a motion.
The charter doesn't say it has to be an ordinance. I mean, the charter just says they have the power to remove with 5 votes. And after that, Harry will have the ability to pursue a public hearing on the matter. But he would be – before that, that's before his removal is final. But in terms of just doing it, they can do it with a simple vote. I think they have to notice the meeting. But beyond that, they don't have to go through the ordinance procedure giving the notices.
And at some point, I think you referenced the charter. It says that he can be suspended pending this hearing. So that could come tomorrow, that perhaps with a motion that they could actually suspend him until they have this full-fledged hearing.
Right. I think he can be removed pending the outcome of that hearing as early as tomorrow, conceivably.
And we know it's a special meeting. And by my count, there are already four council members that aren't going to be there. Not surprisingly, it's the four members who are opposed to this. So if there was to be an ordinance to do this, they actually don't have the votes to even pass that to start with.
That sounds correct.
What if this plays out, what about who could take his place and who would be willing to jump in to take his place?
We talked with David Mann earlier today, and he said that likely one of the assistants would be replaced to his position. Yeah. So John Jewick is obviously a good choice there.
It doesn't seem outsiders would be clamoring to come to Cincinnati yeah. right now. So in-house might be their best bet.
Yeah, that's what's going to be very interesting. I think obviously this is going to end with Harry leaving either way. It just depends on how messy it gets. And I think it's going to be very interesting to watch how difficult it might be for the city to get a new city manager.
I wouldn't be surprised if for the remaining 3.5 years of Cranley's term and this council's term, if the city manager has an interim tag on him or her. I wouldn't be surprised if that. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised.
What I've heard, and I'm not – this is open speculation at City Hall, so I'm repeating what I've heard at City Hall. I've heard other names besides the two current assistant city managers, John Jewick and Patrick Duhaney, I believe mm-hmm. how you pronounce his last name. I've heard former assistant city manager mm-hmm. Sheila Hill-Christian.
I've heard that too.
I've heard former MSD director Gerald Checo. I've heard the name David Rager, who a long time ago was an acting city manager and used to be in charge of the waterworks. Any other names that others have heard that I haven't rattled off?
It's pretty close to what we've heard too. I think the internal pick is a good choice too, because this person knows what they're getting into. They know how to navigate the council members and the mayor as well, at least for an interim basis.
You know, I think it would be a great city manager. I've said this for a while now, and I'm just literally just saying this. I think Roxanne Qualls would be a great city manager. It's not going to happen, but I've said this to Sharon Coolidge several times, and I think she'd be great at it. But of course, you know, with
wouldn't
the political
be a
differences
of the
there,
2013
that's not
campaign.
Going to happen. So don't. I'm not trying to spread any rumors. That's just my thoughts.
What do we know? The process, and I'm assuming that the process is that the mayor can name an interim city manager. Does council have to approve that? I know they have to vote on the permanent city manager, but I'm not sure about the interim. And I should know that, and I don't.
I think we all should know that. That's a good point. We're going to look something up when we leave this meeting.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that, yeah.
There's been a lot of things that have happened related to this. On Wednesday, Harry Black sent out a memo to council members concerned about the mayor's role in economic development projects. Amanda, walk us through that.
Oh, there's a lot to unpack in that one. So
we got plenty of time.
He basically released this memo raising concern about two economic development deals, one about a year and a half old, another about a little less than a year old, both dealing with city-owned property. So the first issue he raised was with this deal that was supposedly promised on the CET parking garage, which is city-owned as far as the air rights go, and a lobbyist who was meeting with then-Economic Development Director Oscar Bedea told the former Economic Development Director that this firm had been promised these air rights in exchange for this fundraiser that he hosted for John Cranley. And then in the other case, basically what happened was Harry raised concern because John Cranley's former chief of staff, who was not working with the city, just to be clear, at that time, was both working on John's reelection campaign and working as a lobbyist for a company that was interested in this kind of deal with city-owned property. And Harry said that it just seemed odd to him that he would be campaigning for the mayor and then also lobbying City Hall for this deal. For a company he was working for.
And on at least the air rights for the CET garage, at least one person involved in that immediately sent a statement and said that it was not true.
Yes. Yeah, so Government Strategies Group, which is a well-known lobbyist firm in the area, they've worked on the FC Cincinnati deal. They're often at City Hall. The lobbyist for them, Jim Benedict, said that that was not the case, that he did not claim that there was a promise made in exchange for a fundraiser.
We also found out this week, we knew that there had been a lawsuit filed by some members of Coast against five council members who had been trading texts concerning the city manager situation. And this week we actually got the 10-page document that said what was in those texts, Jason.
They were, you know, really rallying together. I mean, and succinctly, they were rallying together to keep Harry Black and, you know, basically try to stick it to John Cranley on this whole saga. You know, I don't, in terms of some of the details of the text messages, you want to take that?
I mean, I was going to say,
the reason that this lawsuit was filed is because there is concern that these five council members who, the day that the first motion to put forth a severance package for Harry Black, none of them showed up to that council meeting. It was a special council meeting. But they all scheduled a conference call later in the day to discuss how they would essentially vote on this issue and released a statement. And so that prompted the Brian Shrive with Coast to file a lawsuit file a public records request and then later a lawsuit for these text messages, for their emails, to figure out how did they all come to the conclusion that they feel the same way, all five of them, on this certain issue. So just to be clear, that's why they're is so much concern about these texts.
And this kind of thing has come up over the years in council before, with council members having conversations, whether it's through text messages or phone conversations or meeting together, planning out something they're going to do and then going into council and doing it. And so that it raises all kinds of open records issue. And the city's charter is very clear. Council does no business outside of public view. And so
But one has to wonder, clearly something had to be happening yesterday afternoon because we had two council members saying that Greg Landsman had changed his mind. There had to be conversations going on that was happening.
And the Ohio Supreme Court ruled in 2016 that you cannot conduct public's business and our meetings over text or email or electronic devices.
Yeah, and that's the real big problem with this one in particular is they were all five on this text string. And we don't know for sure. We have a conference call listed for them too as well.
Right. They're allowed to talk. I mean, they can have conversations, but they can't meet as a group to discuss council business.
Well, and as Dan knows from covering the county, I mean, the county is very – they talk about how the aides are running back and forth. And right. I mean, it's – we know that these people consult with one another some way, but you're not supposed to meet in a majority that way.
And Dan, I don't want you to feel left out, but Jason and Amanda and I were actually mentioned in the text messages. Did you know that?
We were honored.
I'm shattered.
On the list. It's almost as exciting as winning a Pulitzer, but not quite.
We were on the list for those who were to get the release when it came out. So we're the other thing that happened this week, the Inquirer had actually filed a lawsuit for the process where two council members were going to interview employees who had concerns about Harry Black. Those were supposed to be closed door. For now, those are on hold. But those hearings may be a moot point now to start with.
They may be, yeah. I mean, we sued over that. The Inquirer filed a suit alleging that would be a violation of the charter because the charter says that all council business must be conducted in public and that seems pretty clear to most of us who follow council that if you're going to do the business of interviewing the city, people complaining about the city manager and go through this formal process and have two council members involved, that seems to constitute council business. So we objected to that. We were not alone. I think most media companies and a lot of other people in town objected to that. But you're right. I mean, now that may never happen. I mean, things have certainly taken off from there. Greg Landsman changing his vote changes the whole dynamic at City Hall, and they may not need to go through any kind of process like that to remove him.
Before we wrap up this topic, does anyone want to weigh in on the news that we learned that maybe some of Mayor Cranley's text messages were lost because he dropped his phone in a hot tub?
I talked with his office about that earlier this week. My understanding is that the text messages are there. The phone was dropped in February, actually, so we should get our records requested.
At his gym as he was working out. He got in the hot tub after he worked out or before he worked out.
I did not get those kind of details, Jason.
So that's where he dropped the phone.
It wasn't at a big hot tub party.
So we advance this.
According to him, no.
So we advance this whole issue to tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock as we wrap up.
It depends. I mean, if Harry Black resigns.
So what do you think? Does he – I'll give you each chance to weigh in. Does he resign or does he play this out to make them terminate him?
I don't know. He seems on a pretty big war path at this point, and I could see him dragging it out even if it's not the best option even for him.
Yeah, I don't see him going quietly. Yeah,
I can't see him resigning unless the package to leave becomes a lot sweeter than it is right now.
We'll get the answers to that maybe tomorrow, maybe next week. Who knows? Dan, we talked about this when we were talking about the city manager, but there was a hearing Tuesday afternoon at Cincinnati City Hall concerning the...
Went into the evening.
It was a five-hour hearing. Concerning the tragic death of Kyle Plush, and who called 911 for help twice as he was trapped in his minivan in the Seven Hills school parking lot, right. And the help that he needed never got to him. Just your take on Tuesday's hearing.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think you have a situation where you have a really dysfunctional government and then you have a crisis develop around it. And it's not unlike what some people will say about the Trump administration. They say, you know, the talk about chaos and confusion and this different way of doing business is all well and good until something happens. And what happens when something bad happens and you really have to deal with a crisis? And I who knows? We don't know the answer to that question. But at City Hall, I think we got an answer when we saw what happens when you do have a crisis develop at a time when city government is not functioning the way it normally would function. And I think that hearing was a product of that. And what you ended up with was not a lot of answers, a really angry family, council members distraught, members of the public who were there distraught. It was not a good look. It was not a good day for the city.
In hindsight, I know a lot of people wanted answers about that particular incident, and most every time there was a specific question about the incident, well, we can't talk about that because the internal police investigation is not complete yet. Would it have been better to maybe, as much as I think they knew they needed to do something, that had they waited until that report was actually out and then had the hearing?
I think there's an argument to be made for that, certainly. But I think in fairness to the folks who called that hearing, they were in a tough spot. You know, the family wanted to hear from the city. They wanted to understand where they were at and what they were doing. And I think there was some thought that if we just get together, we talk about this process, we talk about what we know about the past, what we know about 911 right now and where we're at, that maybe that makes us some progress, even though we can't talk about the findings because we don't know what they are yet. I think that's one of the things that seems to have really bothered the family is when Mr. Young started to speak about, I'm sure everyone did their best and this was just everything went wrong. And I think their feeling was, well, we don't know that yet. I mean, we don't know whether the system worked the way it should work, and we don't know how everyone performed yet because we don't have answers yet. And I think that upset them because I think there was some, some assumptions being made there that maybe weren't justified. And that's the danger of going into a hearing like this. But I think the original idea was, we're talking about this process. It feels like we need to talk about something here, so we'll do that. But obviously, there's some danger in that, too.
And we do know that some of these problems that were discussed on Tuesday have persisted for years.
Absolutely.
Especially the short staffing, some of the technology issues. But I do think there is some question as to whether or not we do know for sure if those contributed to what happened to Kyle Plush. And we still do not have details like the dash cam videos from the police officers run over there. So there's a lot of unanswered questions still, and we're not going to know for sure until that internal report is out.
There have been, I think you've done, Channel 9 has done stories way as back as 2013, maybe an update in 2016 about the problems at 911, the Emergency Communication Center. There have been, I think, at least a dozen memos on the same topic. But yet we heard some council members say that they didn't know there was a problem.
We heard the mayor claim that. We heard the council members claim that. It's really hard to believe. I mean, when this happened last week, we found within minutes the reports that have been filed consistently over the last year. I know firsthand that the CincyStat website is hard to navigate, but that information is all available and it's all online.
Well, those memos were sent to council.
Yeah.
I mean, council saw these memos.
And so here's the thing. No one campaigned aggressively on fixing the 911 center. I mean, to that end, this does fall on really all of City Hall.
Jason, I'll let you, because I know we were sitting down there during the hearing Tuesday night when the family abruptly left after Wendell's, Mr. Young's comments. Walk us through what he was saying and their reaction to it.
So, and I know as we were all sitting there, it was just kind of like this slow-moving freight train coming down the track. Like as he continued to talk and talk and talk, I think we all thought that, you know, this isn't going to end well. And but even though we really didn't know what he was going to say, it just seemed that he was heading in a direction where this was, because you saw people. I mean, literally, you saw the family kind of, you know, squirming in their chairs and other council members sort of turning their heads and staring off a little bit. But essentially what he was saying was, like, at one point he said, you know, from what he has seen so far in that or heard in that meeting, that there's no one person to blame right now. And then at one point he said, you know, he talked about the family, you know, potentially suing, and then he said there's no amount of money that can get your son back, and that's really what set the family off with those comments.
And I think generally accepted, we kind of knew that I mean, you'll hear that in a lot of these situations, no amount of money is going to make right what happened. But I think his wording, had he just stopped at what I just said, it might have been a little easier than to when he went on to. I think I heard there was a witch hunt in some of his comments.
Yeah, it was a slow roll toward a bad ending. I think, you know, you started with that, and it sounded defensive. I don't know what the intent was, but it sounded from someone like all of us who doesn't have the answers yet, was trying to kind of soft pedal a really terrible thing that happened, and I don't think that was his intention, but. You know, it came across as we're assuming the best about everyone involved and we're assuming the best about the system in place, when clearly we know something went wrong. And I think that's what really set the family off. And then the final straw was the suggestion that there might be a lawsuit and money's not going to make you happy. And that was the end of it.
The witch hunt comment, yes, that indicated the politics of it. That my assessment of that was that, you know, he saw this as John Cranley's attempt, or a roundabout attempt, or maybe a direct attempt to put Harry Black on trial, and some of Cranley's comments, you know, alluded to that as well early in the meeting. Obviously, Cranley supporters or part of Cranley's coalition, Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman and Amy Murray are part of that, or head of that committee. Smitherman is, and so, but I'll point out that. Wendell, I honestly, in my heart, don't think that Wendell Young meant to offend the family. It just came off that way. He did come back the next day and apologize publicly, so got to give him credit for that.
And I think part two of, I mean, from the family standpoint as well, not only, first of all, it should be noted that they sat through this entire meeting the day after their son's funeral. But they also told one of our reporters that they hope that Kyle's death could save someone else in the future. So to hear that there's this witch hunt and that no one maybe did anything wrong would have to be really disheartening, when that's the thing that you're hoping from all of this tragedy.
It seemed like the Emergency Communication Center has been under scrutiny. The actual operator who answered Kyle's second call, where she claimed she couldn't hear him, was placed on administrative leave right after the incident, came back to work, I believe, Wednesday, but we're told that she's doing administrative functions, not answering 911 calls. Are the two police officers who responded kind of getting a pass on this? We've not heard.
Well, I'd love to know why they're not on administrative leave and the dispatcher is.
I think there's even some question as to whether they just drove through the parking lots or if they actually got out of their cars and checked vehicles. And we were told on Tuesday that was part of the review, and I don't think they'd even been interviewed yet.
Yeah. And I think that's part of why the family reacted the way they did. We don't know yet what the officers saw, where they went, whether they got out of the car. We don't know for a fact what the operator heard on that second call. We don't know what was relayed exactly. I mean, there's a lot of questions right now about what happened. And you're right, this is a system-wide issue. a lot of things went wrong. And I think, you know, Mr. Young alluded to that at the beginning of his comments when he said everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And there's certainly some truth in that. But we don't know who did what and when. And we don't know what system failures there may have been or not.
And Chief Elliot Isaac was asked directly, by the way, if the officers did get out of the car on Tuesday. And his response was, I don't know.
Yeah, I think this is where the body cam footage is going to be really critical. And I think that will determine whether the officers who were there will be, you know, scrutinized or not. So as we all wait for the body cam to come out footage.
We did, I think it was on Wednesday, Councilmember Greg Landsman said that Captain Gramke, who I believe is in charge of the ECC now from the police department, that they had, council had, he had their full attention. Tell us what you need. If this becomes a budget issue, as tight as the city's budget is, there's a $24 to $27 million deficit. Council has not had the appetite to increase revenues. So if you fund additional money for 911 and ECC, that's going to come with tough choices for other city departments.
Yeah, and we might not have a city manager to make those tough choices. And it's going to be very complicated.
And, you know, I think the budget is probably almost ready to be printed because I believe it was supposed to be released on May the 3rd. And that's what, a week away, week and a half away?
They have open positions there. We know that. They just haven't filled them. And yeah, the money has always been the issue and how much they have to do the job they say they need to do.
And in the meantime, we'll wait for the report, which we are told will be on Tuesday. It was 10 days, so maybe about a week away.
Like Friday, maybe Thursday, Friday, next week.
Earlier on Monday, it's hard to believe that it was Monday when this happened, the city council had a special meeting and actually approved an ordinance that would let FC Cincinnati build a stadium in the West End. And I know, Amanda, this is your favorite topic. So
that happened on Monday?
It was this week.
It was.
So this gives them the green light, but we're still waiting on Major League Soccer.
Right. So pretty much everything with the public financing piece is really put to bed. Obviously, one of the things on Monday that was very confusing was this community benefits agreement, whether or not that's been signed or if it's official. So pretty much the only thing we have left right now that I can envision in the future is zoning coming through council, and then this community benefits agreement will need to come back to council in order for the city just to disperse the funds. So that's been put to bed, and now we're just waiting. It's crazy because we've been waiting since November to see if they get this bid or not.
And it seems on Monday that we were, even before Monday, that you passed this ordinance. Major League Soccer's governing board or whatever it is was meeting on Tuesday. You will have good news. And it kind of landed with a thud Tuesday evening when, well, you're passing this ordinance, help, but we're not there yet.
Well, I had heard, and I don't know what you guys had heard from your sources, but that it was, that they were not going to take a vote, that it was just kind of they wanted this all done before they met. So I don't know if that means that they've already taken this vote and they're just waiting for the good time to announce it or what. But that statement was pretty lousy as far as from the MLS, as far as what we were hoping for.
And one theory, or, you know, I've heard some folks chatter about it, and I don't, it's just a thought, I think, is that potentially the situation going on in Columbus right now, the MLS really wants to work that out first before they are able to kind of make their big splash here in Cincinnati.
So, how long will that take?
And Columbus is that their team could be leaving to go to Texas?
Yeah, well, the Dispatch just reported, I believe it was today, that there was a group of investors that were out looking at sites in a whole new group. So I don't know, that seemed like it might be a positive thing for Columbus.
In Columbus?
Yeah.
Jason, what about the politics of this? There are lots of folks in the West End who are apparently not very happy about this. That was expressed at a community council meeting on Tuesday evening where they're now attempting to impeach the president of the West End Community Council. There are 6 of the 9 council members who are term limited, 3 who aren't, but there are some of those council members who may have ambitions for higher office. Where does this all play out for them and some of the folks who support the West End Community Council members who aren't really enthusiastic about this stadium coming to their neighborhood?
Well, P.G. Sittenfeld, has mayoral aspirations, and he came around there a couple weeks ago to support it and essentially flip the vote. to get the majority to support the West End deal. You know, I give him credit for, you know, that's a tough position for him to be in, but he thought, okay, I'm going to make a tough decision, and ultimately this thing needs to end. And he has some political capital to spend, and so his thoughts were, you know, I think it's going to be rolling out right around the time, or it maybe the mayoral election is happening in 2021. So I think he's thinking that could be a really nice splash there. And also Christopher Smitherman has mayoral aspirations, and he's in support of it as well.
Well, and I think another thing too that had to have come across P.G. Sittenfeld's mind is the last mayoral election, the candidate that lost was dinged so hard over and over again for being anti-development. And this would have been a really easy way to say he voted against the stadium and it went to Newport, or we didn't get the MLS bid. He's an anti-development.
That's a great point. I mean, there were a lot of comparisons going on here between the Children's Hospital issue of last year and this West End thing. And I think that's a great point that Amanda made.
Amanda, I don't want to get you in trouble here if you've not seen this, but before we came on the air, I saw Channel 9 had tweeted that Jeff Birding must have been on one of your shows, and he was talking about what he called paid organizers in the West End to oppose the stadium.
He is basically claiming that, I know, like Josh Spring, for example, with the Cincinnati Homeless Coalition, was at pretty much any public meeting from the school board to the community council. So he's has, I think, some concerns that there were organizations that were opposed to this that might have been paying people to consistently show up to these meetings and make their opposition known. Jeff actually called me and said something about some of the evidence for that, but I haven't had a chance to look at that quite yet.
I think some of the loudest voices opposition to the Weston Stadium are folks who do not live there. Certainly there are residents that have concerns, but there's also been I think this is a good deal. Ultimately, there's no houses that are going to be torn down yet. It's going to drive up some property values. But I think a good plan is in place. I think, you know, definitely that community benefits agreement. The community really needs to rally together now that it's happening and hold the team accountable to live up to that document. And don't let up on that and keep the heat on them.
Well, and I think there's still some work to be done on that CBA, too. I mean, what was presented on Monday was really kind of just seemed like whatever the team had put together. And I think what would help calm down members who are opposed to this in the West End would be having some actual valuable input on that community benefits agreement instead of just being told in a press conference, here's what you're getting. So hopefully council will follow through on that. I know several of the council members who even opposed this deal said that they would be monitoring that.
Before we wrap up this segment, we want to congratulate the Enquirer on this week's – it was an exciting day for you on Monday that you won a Pulitzer Prize. Dan, I think you were one of the co-authors of the series. Am I getting that right?
Terry DeMio and I wrote the story, but I can't emphasize enough that this was a staff effort from the very beginning. I mean, we had 60 people involved in this thing, reporters, photographers, videographers, editors. It was a total staff effort.
And it was a week-long report on heroin.
Yeah, we spent a week immersing ourselves in the community and trying to cover this epidemic from a different perspective and just kind of show people, you know, what's going on every day right in front of their eyes that maybe after so many years of hearing about it, they weren't seeing as so clearly. And so we wanted to kind of just say, this is here every day, and this is what it looks like. And the whole staff got behind it, and that's what we did.
So how did you find out? Did the phone just ring and, hey, congratulations, you won a Pulitzer? Or did somebody know that the call was coming to set everybody up for the celebration?
Believe it or not, I don't do this every year where I'm on the edge of my seat on Pulitzer Day. So it was interesting to see. Terry and I got an email about around noon that day just saying we might be finalists. And that's all we knew up until that point. And so when you see those pictures of everybody screaming and jumping up and down.
So who got the phone call?
We were watching the live stream.
Oh, okay.
We didn't know until they actually said the words at the live stream of the announcement. So it was fascinating to see that process. But up until they said the name, we were all just basically thinking, oh, we're finalists, which means we're runners up. That's great. And then they said our name, and everybody went bonkers. So it was a good day.
It looked like it in the pictures. Yeah. So is there plans to follow up?
Well, Terry DeMio has been covering heroin for us for several years now, and she's going to continue to do that job really well, which is the way she's been covering it for several years. So she's going to stay on that. We have a few other projects we talk about, and I think there's other things we want to do, certainly. So, yeah, we'll continue to be following up with a lot of the people who are in that project, who we wrote about that day. You know, Terry's going to keep covering this thing.
Well, congratulations, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
We've been talking about another busy week at Cincinnati City Hall. My guests were WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Dan Horn, and Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams. After the break, we'll talk about this year's Kentucky General Assembly session. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Dan Hurley. It's our Friday news review. The Kentucky General Assembly finished up its business last week by overriding some of Governor Matt Bevin's vetoes. Joining me on the phone to talk about the session is political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Daniel, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I guess the highlight of General Assembly Day number 59 and number 60 last weekend were the veto overrides. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so the House and the Senate, the General Assembly, they basically passed their version of the budget and their version of the tax bill. And they did that in time so that they would have the ability to override any veto that the governor had on the issue. And just as expected, the governor had issues with both of those bills, and he vetoed both of them. The best way to kind of characterize what he said about it was basically good try, but not good enough. So he liked elements of the bills, but he just didn't think that he thought that they fell short. He thought that they were fiscally irresponsible, and he had issues with just kind of the attempt at tax reform that they did. He felt like it was not comprehensive enough, and that it didn't go as far as he would have liked in terms of completely reforming Kentucky's tax code. And so even though he vetoed those bills, the House and the Senate both voted to override his vetoes, basically saying, we don't care what you have to say, Governor, we're going to pass these bills anyway. And it was interesting because when the House was debating the bill, the governor was kind of tweeting in real time, kind of saying, hey, you don't need to override these. We can call a special session and we can do it in a special session and come up with a better plan. But the legislature just basically ignored him on it. They did pass a cleanup bill or a couple cleanup bills to deal with some of the issues that people had with the budget and with the tax reform bill. But most of those cleanups were more minor things. They weren't as substantial as what was actually in the package.
And I guess the governor's disagreement, I'm going off the top of my head here, but there was some conflicting numbers about the amount of revenue that would be basically his office came up with one number and the Legislative Research Commission came up with another?
Exactly, yeah. So his office said that the budget would be out of balance by around $80 million. And that was a major reason why he vetoed the bill. He called it fiscally irresponsible. Throughout the process, the legislature stood by the analysis of the Legislative Research Commission, but apparently they gave enough cushion in the budget that even if their revenue was short by the amount that the governor's office was saying, they'd still be able to absorb the cost if it fell short. But that's always a hit or miss, right? Because it feels like each year we seem to be having a budget shortfall. So we could eventually have that problem again next year.
Now, you mentioned that the legislature passed a cleanup bill to fix some of those things. Now, they have now adjourned. Is it possible that the governor will veto that, or is he okay with the cleanup bill?
We don't know whether or not he's okay with the cleanup bill. So, yes, it is possible that he'll veto it. The House and the Senate were saying that, hey, these cleanup bills contain most changes that the governor wanted. So it's unlikely that he's going to veto this thing. But we really don't know. In terms of us, the political reporters at the Herald Leader, we're checking the website to see if the governor is passing down any vetoes this week.
There were last Friday, and I'm assuming Saturday, a lot of teachers who came to Frankfort upset about the cuts to education funding. Did their presence sway lawmakers when they were voting on these veto overrides?
I don't think that it swayed their votes on the veto override. It swayed their messaging. So this budget contains funding for education, right? So it raises the per pupil spending to a high level. It includes funding for transportation costs to K-12 schools, which is something that the governor had cut out of the budget, and it fully funds teachers' pensions. So these are all the things that the teacher or that Republican lawmakers are bragging about when they say, "Hey, we passed this budget that funds education." There's caveats to that, right? And the Democrats will tell you, yeah, you funded education, but you didn't do it nearly enough, and that teachers and public schools, they need more money. And so it's this argument that's basically, it's a little nuanced, I guess, because the Republicans are going to say, hey, we funded education, and the Democrats are going to say, well, you didn't fund it enough, and in the process, you raised taxes on the poor, because there was a study that showed that the tax increases are going to raise taxes for 95% of Kentuckians, despite the fact that everybody will be getting that income tax break, or that most people will be getting that income tax break. So it turns into a political argument more than it turns into whether or not they were influenced. I know that the KEA had encouraged Democrats to vote to override the veto, and the Democrats did not vote to override.
One other thing that the legislature passed and the governor signed was the pension reform. And this week, the pension reform is now facing a lawsuit from the Attorney General and some others.
Yeah, that lawsuit began, I believe, Wednesday or maybe yesterday, Thursday. It began this week. The argument there for the Attorney General is that it violated the inviolable contract. And he says that the legislature violated statute when they passed this bill.
And the inviolable contract means that once these benefits were promised to folks, you can't change them.
Exactly. And so the Beau Barnes, who's the general counsel for KTRS, said that he didn't think that it violates the inviolable contract. So there's a question on whether or not how this lawsuit will do in court. Apparently, they're expecting a ruling on the pension bill by July, but we'll just have to wait and see. It's tied up in the court system, and from here, they'll make a ruling on the Attorney General's arguments, and we'll see where it goes.
In about the last 30 seconds we have left, are there any talk of any special sessions, or are legislative members done until the next regular session begins in January?
I would be surprised if we see a special session anytime soon, but it's always possible. I know that the governor really wants to see more substantial comprehensive tax reform, and he would push for that special session, but his relationship with the General Assembly is probably not at the best it's ever been right now. So I'd be surprised, but hey, I prediction is the lowest form of journalism. So
just like here in Cincinnati when we try to predict anything. We've been talking about the recently concluded Kentucky General Assembly session. My guest was political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director was Josh Elstro. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in today for Dan Hurley. Have a great weekend. This is 91.7 WVXU.